So that with poetry, short fiction, the drama, we are way back in the past. If we talk about the novel, the first novel as such that is called by literary critics a novel, distinct in itself, that is a long fiction with multiple plots, many characters, that tells an extended story or a series of stories, published in 1605. You know it well, it's called Don Quixote. And Cervantes, in writing Quixote, came up with something that was not only very popular, but it was very new. There had been slightly more extended fictions before, but they tended to be romances of a kind, stories of knights and dragons and ladies, and of course that is what Cervantes is parodying in his novel. Quixote thinking himself a knight and riding out to right wrongs in the world. But what we get is not something that's not romantic, but something that is very down to earth. Why did this happen? For a couple of reasons. One, the printing press. It became much easier to get and acquire manuscripts. They no longer had to be written by hand. As I mentioned last night, one of the ironies of Solzhenitsyn's fiction is that it passed, copies of it were passed, written by hand. The way manuscripts were forwarded and reached the public years before. I mean, all the way back before the printing press arrived. So the first reason, the printing press. Books became more available. Second, there was a burgeoning middle class. People started having more money. And as a result of certain changes in the way they lived their lives, they not only had money, they had a little bit of leisure time. They had a little bit more time to do something, and one of the things they did was read, because literacy was also spreading at that time. And, final thing, they wanted to be entertained in that way. It was a new form of entertainment. So that the first part of Quixote was enormously popular, 1605. It's very curious that what I call the greatest comic work ever written, and that's Quixote, and the greatest tragic work, Shakespeare's King Lear, came out in the same year, 1605. Two crazy old men. One of them crazy in a funny way, the other crazy in a tragic way. And to compel that, and to add to that mountain of irony of those two dates, Shakespeare and Cervantes died on the same date. Just one of those very peculiar facts that means absolutely nothing, but I thought I'd point it out. Now, when the novel arrived on the scene and became popular, it became very clear that what people wanted to read about was themselves. What they were interested in reading about was life as they knew it. And since those who were buying the novel were basically middle class, coming into a little money, sort of proud of the world they were living in, they liked to read about their world. And what defines Quixote as the first novel is we're not in some fantastic fantasy world other than in Quixote's poor dried up brain, okay? What we have in the novel, the dusty roads of Spain, the inns that he would stop at, the shepherds that he encounters, the ladies of the evening he will bump into. He is meeting the population of Spain. He is riding the roads of Spain. He is eating the food of Spain. And the Spanish loved it. They saw that this was their world. Someone was writing about the world they knew. And as a result, the best definition that we can give of the novel that sets it apart from all other literary forms is that the novel is an extended fiction with multiple characters and often multiple plots that creates or recreates a real world. The novel tends to be realistic. The Iliad is not realistic. It gives us a sense of war, but those characters are magnificent, monumental, heroic. The same thing with the Greek drama and even the Shakespearean drama. Those figures are larger than life. Sancho Panza is not larger than life other than being larger than most of the other Spanish characters in the book, okay? He's very real. And when he's eating his onions or when he's sneaking off and trying to sleep in the bushes and catching a little catnap, or when he's going off to, as he says it, do that which no other man can do for him, unquote. We have a real character in a real world behaving in a very real way. And that was new to the novel. So that if you think about the novels that come after Quixote, their great strength, and one reason we return to them, is that given the fact that the novel recreates for us a specific time, a specific place with real characters, life lived as it was lived, we can re-enter those worlds. Our clearest sense of what those times and places were like can come to us from the novel. So that if I want to know what Puritan New England was like, what it was like to live with those Puritans, I will turn to The Scarlet Letter, because Hawthorne recreates it. If I want to have some sense of what the whaling industry was like, it is vanished. There's nothing left. There's a little museum and maybe a boat or two left. But we have no idea. We cannot have a sense of what was at one time the greatest industry along the eastern seaboard. It's gone. It's vanished. Well, it's not completely. There's Moby Dick. And every single aspect of that whaling world, what the ships were like, what the voyages were like, how the men behaved, is captured in realistic detail in those novels, in that novel. So we know what the whaling industry was like. If you want to know what Russia was like during the Napoleonic Wars, you read War and Peace. And you will get the feel, the sense of lived life in elaborate detail in that book. That's what the novel does. It is the strength of the novel. Now, the reason I emphasize this is that what Solzhenitsyn was doing in writing One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich is what a great novelist does. He is setting down in realistic detail what life was like in a very specific enclosed world and rendering it with a vividness of imagination and at the same time a reality that recreates that world. Why was this so controversial? It was controversial simply because no one knew the world existed, or if they did, it was being covered up. That world of the Gulag, that world of the Soviet Union slave labor camps, was either a well-kept secret, or if you knew it was there, you didn't speak a word about it. And it may have been a great grinding mill that, as I said last night, ground up somewhere between 100 and 110 million Russian citizens, but nobody spoke about it. Because if you opened your mouth, you might become a statistic. And therefore, it was hush-hush. The first thing that Solzhenitsyn is trying to do in writing the novel, therefore, is open up that world to a wide world. Let the citizens of his native land know what was happening there in vivid detail. And then by extension, let the world know what had happened in those camps. For this reason, he does not take either the worst possible camps that existed in the Gulag. For those of you that weren't here last night, just very quickly, it's an acronym. Gulag is simply an acronym from the Russian letters spelling out Soviet slave labor camps, okay? That's basically all it is. And that's what that whole system of prison camps, thousands and thousands of them, came to be called, the Gulag. He does not choose the worst of the camps, nor does he choose the very best of the camps. He talks about that world in the first circle. That is the camp where they kept the mathematicians, the scientists who lived comfortably. What he is seeking is that camp that is somewhere in the middle, in which we have a typical camp set throughout the entire series of camps, something that if you were picked out, arrested, and sent off, there was a good chance you might go to. You might end up at some place worse. If you were brilliant, you might end up someplace better. But it's like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, Goldilocks with the porridge. To write about these camps would be too much. To write about these camps would be too little. This camp is just right. Okay? It is an average camp. Then what does he do? Having chosen just an average camp to describe, he chooses an average man. He is writing, and in this, he is very much in line with 20th century literature, a novel without a hero. Our hero is not heroic. He is simply an average John, and that, of course, is what Ivan means, with an average name, an average fellow from an average background, just another average Russian who one day was astonished to find himself thrown into this whole system. There is nothing exceptional about him. There is a way in which the central figure is a bit bland. That is deliberate, because what we are focusing on is a kind of one man, any man, every man, all men, who at any moment could find themselves sent there. Ivan Denisovich Shukov is standing in for all of humanity. And to represent all of humanity, he is a kind of blank slate. He has some personality. He has a past. We find out things about him. He is not particularly remarkable. And then to complete it, what do? We don't get a history of that camp. We don't look at it, how it was founded, how it developed. He will save that for the Gulag Archipelago when he talks about all the camps and gives a history of the entire system. What we have here is one day, one average day of one average man in one average camp. This is not dramatic. And those of us who read it now, not having lived through it and not having the sense of the panic it caused in the Soviet regime or the excitement it caused among the Russian people, look at it and our first reaction is, well, there's not much happening here. And we have to say that's correct and that's deliberate. It is part of the plan of the novel. In one sense, this was the first novel he attempted to get published. He didn't choose stronger material because if you have a desperately sick body, the first medicine you have to put into it had better be a fairly mild medicine. Something that's too strong would shock and kill. And therefore, what we get here is a fairly tepid dose of the medicine of truth. But it's true. But even this caused an enormous furor. What happened when he created this little world, a world he had known, that does what art should do? It reflects a truth, a very real truth that was out there. And in that sense, he is doing what the great novelist has always done, simply reflecting a reality that is absolutely true. What happened when he sent it off? And we have to understand the sheer courage, the guts to send this manuscript off in the first place. Given the kinds of things people were being arrested for and tossed into the camps, to actually submit to a literary magazine this manuscript could have meant the next day he became a non-person, the manuscript was burned, and he was back in the camps for good. Why did he take the chance? He took the chance in the early 60s. Because for one brief moment in the history of the Soviet Union, there was a thaw. The ruler was named Nikita Khrushchev. And during those years in the early 60s, Khrushchev decided that there had to be a little bit of truth told about the Stalin years. Khrushchev realized that those years had been so destructive, so horrific, that what the country had been through had demoralized it so that if there was any hope of prolonging the communist system or getting some sort of life out of the people again, perhaps a little bit of truth might do it. And it was allowed to be said that maybe Comrade Stalin had made a few mistakes, killing a few million, tens of million of his people. That wasn't said. Maybe Comrade Stalin had gone a bit overboard in some of the things he had attempted, like digging the White Sea Canal and ordering it done in about 6 months, including winter, at the cost of 300,000 men who died as they dug and were simply thrown into the hole. Maybe Comrade Stalin had gone a bit overboard in his pressure tactics in trying to see to it that those counter-revolutionaries didn't get a grip on the world, like those children I mentioned last night who knocked the poster off the wall accidentally while they were playing. and all went to the camps, as did their families, because the families had obviously told them to do it, counter-revolutionary activity. Maybe he went a little overboard there. We're talking not much in the way of a thaw. We're talking a few small admissions. But there had been a break. There was a bubble of truth rising in the midst of the poison. And Solzhenitsyn saw that break and thought, it's now or never, and took the manuscript of One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich and sent it to Novy Mir, the prominent literary magazine. We have nothing like it. I can't even come close to thinking of anything like it. Everybody in the Soviet Union read this magazine. The editor was highly respected, and he was a good man who loved literature. He could only publish crap for the most part, you know, again, because art was state controlled. Boy loves tractor, boy marries tractor, okay? Boy has breakdown with tractor, you know, and boy gets back together with tractor. You could publish that sort of garbage because that was socialist realism, okay? So that he could put, and it ate him up because he loved great literature. Named Tvardovsky. Apparently a wonderful man. He shows up in the Oak and the Calf, Solzhenitsyn's memoir of trying to get his works published. Great man. A man tortured by the system he was living under. Well, what happened? The manuscript shows up, and it is every editor's dream. He opens the envelope, he pulls out the manuscript, he starts reading and realizes he has in his hands a work of absolute genius. That he is holding in his hands one of the great works of fiction ever written. And then he realizes he can't publish it. A life's dream come true, and there's nothing I can do about it. And the man was tormented, was tortured. If he had been smart, he would have stuck it in a safe, locked it, and simply let it be discovered sometime in the future if truth should ever be restored to the country. He couldn't do it. Partially because he felt a need to give the truth to his readers, and partially out of pride, because if he published this, it would make his name forever. So what he did was hand the manuscript up one level in the bureaucracy to the figure directly above him who was in charge of censoring the magazine and said, I have a manuscript here. I'm interested in publishing it. Why don't you take it and read it and see what you think? You think this is something I could publish? He didn't say, this is dynamite. This will blow up in our hands. But it's a work of genius. Read it. It was passed up. The man above him, the censor of the magazine, read it and returned it and said, it's a work of absolute genius. But we can't publish this. There's no way you can publish that. Tvardovsky insisted, we must. The censor said, we really should. It's magnificent. It's great. We probably should. But I'm not taking responsibility for it. So I think and it went up the chain to the censor's overseer. He passed it up. Same thing. It was read. This is brilliant. This man's a genius. There's no way you can publish this. But it must be published. A giant has appeared among us. There's a genius walking among us. What do we do? And they would have meetings and conferences. You can imagine the torment. And up it went, and up it went, and up it went. One little handwritten manuscript. Okay, up it went, until finally, at the last meeting of everybody concerned, they said, there's only one thing we can do. We send it to Comrade Khrushchev. And it went to the top. Imagine, if you will, assuming Bill Clinton can read, imagine, if you will, a literary manuscript that's being debated in terms of shall we publish it, going to the White House, and the president saying, I'm going to Camp David for the weekend, I'll take it with me, I'll read it, and I'll let you know. I mean, we can't conceive of that. That is what happened. Khrushchev was going off to his dacha in the country. You realize, of course, everyone in the Soviet Union lived equally, which means everyone had palatial mansions and grounds stretching for miles where they drove in their limousines. Everyone. That's because it was the workers' paradise, after all. So anyway, Khrushchev goes to his dacha in the country with the manuscript, reads it, and came back and said, publish it. It's a great work. That was his first mistake. His second mistake, which occurred at almost the same time, we're talking 1962. The next mistake came in October of 1962 when he confronted President Kennedy over missiles in Cuba and backed down. In a major confrontation with the United States, Khrushchev backed down, and those two things did it. And he found himself out of power shortly thereafter. But what had happened in the meantime is that the presses had rolled and everybody bought up the few remaining copies, and they spread everywhere throughout the country and caused a sensation. And suddenly, and this is back to my initial point, everyone knew what that camp system was like. And every family had had someone or perhaps many who had gone there. And suddenly you knew what they had lived through. Not at the best, not at the worst, but just an average camp. It was the first breath of truth in decades in that country. I want to read one thing. This came, I thank the young man who sent this to me. He sent the interview, he sent this other little article written by a Russian, a young Russian man who came over, made a pilgrimage to Vermont to find the house after Solzhenitsyn went back to Russia, just because he wanted to see where he had been in this country. He started making pilgrimage to all the Solzhenitsyn sites because of the importance of this man in the young man's life. And listen to this. I had always wanted to see this house. Why? The answer can probably be found in the mass hysteria which surrounded Solzhenitsyn's name in the Soviet Union of my youth. That is not an understatement. Mass hysteria. All his books were confiscated from shops and libraries. That happened shortly after Ivan Denisovich was published. It had a few months, it had a few years, it was out there. And one could easily end up in prison for simply possessing, let alone reading, any of his works. I shall never forget the feeling of danger when, as a 16-year-old, I read a tattered copy of One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. Hiding the book under the blanket in my bed, I finished it in one sleepless night. Next morning, I had to pass it on to the next person in line by the light of a small torch. That was after it was published. That was after it was out there. Mass hysteria, he says, and that's what happened. I quote Solzhenitsyn again, one word of truth outweighs the whole world. And this small work of absolute truth, rendered in realistic detail, began the overturning of that world. It began the process. Now, just very quickly, he then thought, finally I can get everything published. He sent the first circle to Tvardovsky. He sent Cancer Ward. The editor reads these longer novels and can't believe it. Just one work of genius after another. And then he's told, you will not print anything else by this man. That's it. And they did get locked up in a safe. And were not published in Russia until the 1990s. Just sat in the safe for a long time. The editor of the magazine, hounded to death by the authorities, blamed for what had happened. Solzhenitsyn, briefly, the most famous man in the country, and then booted out of the writers' union and attacked from every side, his fellow writers, the government, people who had been his friends. And as I said last night, he was on the road to becoming a non-person, even though he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. It was a bombshell. And curiously, it's just an average book. One day in the life of one man in one camp. But it was sufficient because it's functioning the way a great novel functions. It's telling the truth. And it's rendering that day-to-day truth in realistic detail. But let's look at that day. Let's just look quickly at that day. It's an average day. But we can begin to get a sense of what he's doing if you look at the structure. Something as simple as, how is a day structured? Well, a day is structured for us by what happens in the sky. Okay? We get up in the dark and they get up in the dark. And when they get up, what do we see? I'm on page 18 in this edition. Okay? Just adjust it. It's close by. If you have trouble finding these little references, you can probably locate them later. I can even go through later and find the corresponding references if you want. So maybe don't worry about it now. You might just listen. The camp lights had chased the stars from the sky, and it was as dark as before. We get up in the morning, and there is light there, but what's the light? It's not the light of starlight. That's gone. That's blocked out. If you will, God's creation is blocked out by what? Camp lights, the prison camp. And from such a simple little reference, we get that battle that's going to rage throughout the book. And he puts it that way, that quietly and that subtly. We have the totalitarian regime lighting up the prison camp all night long because they don't trust any of those people. And what they are doing is blotting out God's starlit sky. We have a battle of the lights, the prison lights of the totalitarian communist regime and God's starlight in the sky, and the prison lights are winning. It was as dark as before. Throughout the day, there are references to the sky, the sun, the stars. Very simple. We go off to work, and they are marched off to the work site, and the first thing that happens is that a dim red sun had risen over the deserted compound. You can barely see the sun. Why? Because it's red. Well, I don't think I need to explain that one to you, okay? The very sun coming up in the morning of that long day of work that's going to stretch on for a long while is very dim. You can barely see it. There's hardly any sun there, but what's there is red. And the color radiates at that moment. Those people who read this book got those references. They knew about the reds. They knew what that represented. We continue. This is a wonderful moment, especially on a night when the government has told us we have to set our clocks ahead. I'm on page 67 here. So for you, it should just be a couple of pages ahead. A couple of pages ahead, not far ahead. So 67 here. The sun is directly overhead. It's sure to be 12, Shukov announced. The sun's over the top already. If it is, the captain retorted, it's 1 o'clock, not 12. How do you make that out? Shukov asked in surprise. The old folks say the sun is highest at dinner time. Maybe it was in their day, the captain snapped back. Since then, it's been decreed that the sun is highest at 1 o'clock. Who decreed that? The Soviet government. The captain took off with a handbarrow, but Shukov wasn't going to argue anyway. As if the sun would obey their decrees. It's a wonderful moment. Wonderful moment. We're going to rearrange time itself. Why? Because the Soviet government says so. Okay? As you turn your clocks ahead tonight, remember that. Okay? I could follow this pattern all the way through. I'm just giving you some of them. Just remember, anytime anyone in this novel looks upward, you're finding out something more than it's saying directly. Because even as this was published, this is a book in code. But it's the simplest code. It's the simplest code. The stars in the sky, the sun, time, that's God's work. No, it's the Soviet government's work. Kaboom. Page 170. It's near the end. It's near the end. And very simply, night has come again. Night has come again. Last moments right before we go to bed. The wolves are out sunbathing. It's a full moon. Okay, it's a wonderful line. It's so bright that the wolves are out sunbathing in the moonlight. Give us a light, old man. He lit up just inside the door and went out on the porch. Wolf sunshine was what they jokingly called the moonlight where Shukov came from. Peasant wisdom as opposed to Soviet orders. Good humor and connected with nature. The moon had risen very high, as far again, and it would be at its highest. Sky white with a greenish tinge, stars bright but far between, snow sparkling white, barracks walls also white, camp lights might as well not be there. And by the end of the day, when night comes again, because it has been a good day, and I'll have to define what that means later, but it's been a good day, as we make our way through that day and survive, God's moonlight is beaming down on the camp, turning everything white, and you can't see the prison camp lights. They're blotted out by what? God's glory. God's created glory. It's a wonderful touch. It's a wonderful moment. But those are the parameters of our day. And that is the parameter of the day of the book. The prison lights, which rule and reign at the beginning, are finally overcome by the bright full moonlight at the end of the book. And even with that bright moonlight, you can see the stars again. God's creation is there and visible. As I say, an example of the way he is structuring and ordering things, and the readers would have picked up on these little things. Here's another one. Since I've mentioned the Soviet government already, let's get down to it. The whole reason that these people are in this prison camp is because they have defied that perfect utopian workers' paradise, the Soviet Union, that place where the great experiment was first tried, and according to the government, has triumphed, which means the book is loaded with communist theory. Okay? I'm simply going to take one example of how he treats communist theory in the novel. We, had we grown up there as he did, would have had this stuff beaten into our heads. The way that the old nuns used to catechize the children, okay, with rulers and just blammo, 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 okay, just, you learn this stuff, blammo, except what the old nuns were teaching was truth. What these poor people grew up with, lies, but drilled into their head with even more ferocity. So let's take one of those lies. What is the lie? The lie is this. From each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. Okay? I work, I do my work, but because I'm living in a fair and just economic system, if I work hard, I will get what I need, but if there are unfortunate ones around who need some of it more than I do, then the government will see that it gets passed to them, and what we end up with is perfect equality. As I said earlier, that's why everyone had a dacha in the country and a big limousine to drive in and caviar every night. Okay, it was everywhere. They all have this. It was a lie. Everyone knew it was a lie. But you can't say it's a lie. You can't say it's a lie unless you sneak it in. Unless you sneak it in. And here's how he does it. Page 87 here. Let me just read it. A good rate for the job. The gang bosses are going out, and every day they have to fight in terms of the rate they're going to get. Here's the work we're going to do today. Here's how many men I have on it. We arrange the rates. Okay, the end of the day, we do this work. What do we get? It's mathematical. It's scientific. The government has declared it scientific. And that's why they have committees who have decided this. This is why we have a bureaucracy that implants it. This is why the gang boss goes and gets it all worked out that morning. A good rate for the job means good rations for 5 days. Well, 4 days more likely. The bosses would appropriate 1 day's rations and hand out the standard minimum for every gang in the camp, good or bad. Fair shares all around, they called it. Fair to everybody, but they were saving at the expense of the Zek's belly. The Zek is the poor slob in the camp. True enough, a Zek's stomach can put up with anything. If today's no good, we'll stuff ourselves tomorrow. That was the dream the whole camp went to bed with on minimum ration days. Just think. It was 5 days work for 4 days eats. That is an open attack on communist theory and the way the Soviet system was run. We read it as simply as, you know, it's just, there's nothing to it. They're cheated out of a day's rations. No. That is an attack. And what it is making clear is, there may be theory, but here's reality. You can sit in Moscow and have your wonderful theories, but here's how we're living. And we are being cheated. And at every turn, that cheating is going on. Proving there is no such thing as scientific economic theory. Because whatever is happening in terms of material goods in the world, even if you call it the most important thing in any human life, you may call it that, but the fact of the matter is this. Human beings enter in, and human beings on occasion don't operate according to theory. They're occasionally selfish and unfair. And there are places, as the book goes along, where this finally just begins to explode. Near the end, the packet, the parcel arrives. The parcel's coming, as you notice through this. It's just, you know, everyone is obsessing and dreaming of parcels, lining up to get parcels, hoping that parcels will come. The excitement when someone does get a parcel, the possessiveness when the parcel is there. What's in the parcel? It's just, you know, what? Some people take the view that a man with a parcel is always a tightwad. You have to gouge what you can out of him. But when you come to think of it, it's easy come, easy go. Even those lucky people are sometimes glad to earn an extra bowl of gruel between parcels or scrounge a butt. A bit for the warder, a bit for the team foreman, and you can't leave out the trustee in the parcel room. If you do, he'll mislay your parcel next time around, and it'll be there a week before it gets on the list. Then there's the clerk in the storeroom where all the groceries have to be handed in. Cesar will be taking a bagful there before work parade next morning to be kept safe from thieves and hut searches. And because the commandant has so ordered, if you don't make the clerk a handsome gift, he'll pinch a bit here and a bit there. He sits there all day behind a locked door with other men's groceries, the rat, and there's no way of checking up on him. Then there's payment for services rendered by Shukov to Cesar, for instance. Then there'll be a bit for something for the bathhouse man, so he'll pick you out a decent set of clean underwear. Then there's the barber who shaves you with paper, wiping the razor on a scrap of paper, not your bare knee. It may not amount to much, but you have to give him 3 or 4 cigarettes. Then there'll be somebody in CES to make sure your letters are put aside separately and not lost. Then supposing you want to wangle a day off and rest up in the compound, you need to fix the doctor. You're bound to give something to your neighbor who eats from the same nightstand, like the captain does with Cesar, and counts every bite you take. The most shameless Zek can't hold out against that. So those who always think the other man's radish is plumper than their own might feel envy, but Shukov knew what was what. And didn't let his belly rumble for other people's goodies. We've got bribery. We have a system that runs only on bribery. And it may be, as it's presented in the novel, one package coming to one man in one camp. But if you don't bribe everyone in the camp, your life is going to be miserable. If they know that parcel arrived and you didn't give some here as bribes, then your life's going to be hell. And that is symptomatic of the whole country. The whole country running that way about everything. The people read it, they must have roared with laughter. Because what he is doing is attacking the entire Soviet economic system through one little parcel. One little parcel. But anybody who read that package, or read that passage, living at that time, knew that what we have is an average day in an average camp with an average man, which is like the whole country. The whole country is a camp. The whole country is under the prison lights. The whole country runs on bribery and theft and inequality and corruption. If that is the case, then the whole country should collapse. And eventually it would, but it held on for a long while for this simple reason. Let me read the end of that passage to you again, because here we go into sort of the other side of the novel, which is not just about Soviet history. It is about larger issues that any great, great work of literature always has to touch. And that has to do with human nature. So those who always think the other man's radish is plumper than their own might feel envy. Let me just remind you, one of the 7 deadly sins. But Shukov knew what was what and didn't let his belly rumble for other people's goodies. Our hero, not an extraordinary man, just an ordinary man, not much of a hero, But he is not filled with envy. In the midst of this corruption,